Coming up on this episode of the NHL At The Rink podcast, we talk to Emily Benjamin. She's covering the Florida Panthers and the Tampa Bay Lightning, and we also hit on the Boston Bruins with her. We talk Mike Sullivan and where he could end up, and we go all around the playoffs and end with maybe the best story in the playoffs. All of that and more coming up on this episode of the NHL At The Rink podcast.
NHL At The Rink is presented by Skip, the official food delivery app of the NHL.
Welcome into another episode of the NHL At The Rink podcast. It's brought to you by Skip. Skip to the good part and get groceries, meals, and essentials delivered right to your door on Skip. Sean, how's Vegas for you? You enjoying the Golden Knights and Wild series? It's a way better series, Sean, than I thought it was going to be.
It's been fantastic. It's been really good. The games have been good. Both coaches are great in explaining what they're trying to do. There's been no shortage of stories, good and bad. The weather wasn't too bad in Minneapolis, St. Paul, so that's always a plus. I missed their horrible storms yesterday. I don't know if everybody got out. So I missed that. I was already here because of the 2 days off. And now tonight we play a pivotal game five. And I think it'll determine what happens in the series.
Well, yeah, there's no question. By the way, we're going to have Emily Benjamin. She is our Boston-based senior writer for NHL.com, but she is now Florida-based, covering the Panthers and Lightning series. That interview will be coming up here shortly. Sean, all right, we're recording this the day of a game. So you could dive into a lot of different details of what's happening in the Vegas and Minnesota series, but it could all change in just a couple of hours. We know that. But one thing that won't change is the impact that Kirill Kaprizov has on this Minnesota Wild team. And I think going into these playoffs, I'm guilty of it. I don't know if you were or not. I'm guilty of a lot of things going into these playoffs. A lot of things are going against what I thought was going to happen. But we can get to that in a moment here. The impact that Kaprizov has on this lineup. Like, I think because he was out for so long this season, you almost forget how big of an impact this guy has. When he was in the lineup, they were one of the top teams. They were getting great goaltending, but they were scoring goals. They were generating a lot of offense and chances, and they were going really well. When he was out of the lineup, and they had other injuries too, Eric's neck being notable, obviously. But when he was out of the lineup, you know, it became a question of are the Wild even going to make the playoffs? Well, he's in the lineup now, and you're seeing it up close and personal, but like this impact that he has, I think we forgot about how big of a player this is. Maybe not forgot or underestimated how big of a player this is. He's causing all kinds of havoc for the Vegas Golden Knights.
He's incredible, and Vegas doesn't have an answer for him. They've tried to go top line versus top line, power versus power, and the Jack Eichel line has got its lunch fed to it.
Yeah, it has.
Jack Eichel got his first point in the game four overtime win of the series. He's minus seven, and late in that game, Bruce Cassidy waved the white flag, and he said, I can't do this anymore. And he threw everything into a blender, and he came out with the craziest thing you could come out with. He put William Karlsson, his number two center, on the same line as Jack Eichel, his number one center, and you know, said, here's how I'm going to go about it. It helps defensively. It helps, obviously, on faceoffs. Like I said, Jack got his first point in that game. Mark Stone got his first point in that game. He's a minus five. It top gun-wise, it has not gone well for Vegas yet. Here we are in game five, and it's 2-2.
Well, yeah. I mean, well, that's the thing. That's because they're deep and they're big and they're physical and they're good, right? I mean, that to me is why it's 2-2 right there. But, you know, Eichel's going to have to figure this out. We'll see if he does in game five. But Kaprizov, I just wanted to make that point because just Kaprizov is, I mean, if you didn't know it already, you know it now, the impact that this guy has on the Minnesota Wild. Now, what do you make, Sean, of all the West series going 2-2? Until Dallas beat Colorado to go up 3-2, and all the East series going 3-1. Is there something to be said on how the season went, do you think, with that too, with the West and how we were looking at it and saying, I mean, there's six or seven teams in there that could win the Stanley Cup. In the East, we were looking at three or four.
Dan, as the poet laureate Jim Morrison once said, the West is the best.
The West is the best.
And Bruce Cassidy tried to say it yesterday, and then he tried to kind of walk away from it because he didn't want to upset any of his coaching brethren in the East. But it's parity, and the West was so tight and so close. You know, even the wild cards, like you spoke about Minnesota. Minnesota was one of the best teams in the league before Kaprizov and Ek got hurt. And then St. Louis won, what, 14 games in a row to get back in? Like, they're playing better hockey than the top teams in the West. So, like, Winnipeg got no favors done to it by drawing a St. Louis team that's just rolling on all cylinders. So I just think I thought that this is what we were going to get, right? I thought some of those East series were somewhat mismatched.
Not heavy.
They were mismatched,
yeah,
if that's a word. It's no mushy middle, but they were mismatchy.
I like it.
And that's not the case here. I think in the West, you look at anyone, and I think maybe I thought that the series I'm covering was the one that wasn't going to be even.
Right. That's my point on Kaprizov.
Well, it's a couple of things. Like, Matt Boldy's really good. Brock Faber is ridiculous. He's played over 30 minutes in the overtime game. He plays 27 minutes regularly. He just controls games. And Philip Gustafson's been really, really good. And Aiden Hill hasn't. He got pulled in game three. There was some question whether he'd come back in game four. They came back. He was good in game four, and he won the game, but I thought Gus was better. Like, Vegas dominated that game four territorially, and Gus kept them in it for a long time. He's playing at a level that I've rarely seen him play, and it's a combination of things. Mentally, I think he's a lot stronger. Physically, he's more fit. And, you know, I talked to his goaltending coach back in Sweden yesterday, Linda Blomqvist, who's with Luleå, and has been his goalie coach since he's 15, and works with him every summer and talks to him every six games or so, not in the playoffs, but during the regular season, and kind of does a check-in with him. And you know, she talked about how he's grown mentally and you know, where he's at with his game now, and it's probably as strong as he's ever been, and I think it's shown on the ice.
Well, listen, I mean, before the Wild season started to turn because of injuries, Gustafson was one of the best goalies in the league. The conversation was all about Connor Hellebuyck. Then Andre Vasilevsky joined it. Darcy Kuemper was always kind of on the fringes, and he's a Vezina finalist, by the way, along with Hellebuyck and Vasilevsky. But Gustafson was right there. His numbers were terrific. And you look at his regular season numbers, Sean. I mean, they're outstanding. He had a 2.56 goals against average and a .914 save percentage, and he played 58 games. I mean, those are outstanding numbers for a starting number one goaltender, a true number one goalie. So the fact that he's been playing well and outplaying Aiden Hill doesn't surprise me in the least. It's just that the Wild season started to turn because they couldn't score. I mean, they were scoring, you know, over three goals a game when they had Kaprizov on the lineup. They were scoring under 2.5 without him. It's very hard for a goalie to be able to win and make the kind of difference he needs to be able to make for a team that can barely get three goals, can't get three goals a game.
Yeah, I think he's freer now. I think he knows, like, look, in game three, he made a huge mistake on Vegas's first goal. And he was like, I was so mad at myself. Like, I was yelling at myself. And I just had to reset because I knew we were going to get it back. And I had to make the next save. And I did. And then, you know, they ended up winning 5-2. And it wasn't really close. And I think that's where the growth has come, right? Like, he understood immediately, what am I doing? Like, why am I beating myself up? This isn't the end. Whereas during the regular season, I think sometimes it was. And you know, he was able to reset and mentally refocus and then let Minnesota take care of it, let the Kaprizov and Boldy show go, right? Yeah. And you know, they weren't as good in game four. Each had an assist. They've had a point in every game in this series, but they were each held to an assist in game four. And I finally didn't have to write about Kaprizov again. somebody else got a little bit of love. The Wild are going to go. They have other really good players. Foligno's been a difference maker in this series with his physicality. But they're going to go as Kaprizov and Boldy go in favor. Yeah. It's those three guys.
Definitely. It is. And they're showing up big time. And Vegas's guys need to start showing up. Maybe they will at the game, you know, game five tonight, Tuesday night. Sorry. I got my days mixed up. It's the playoffs. Tuesday night. Game five. And also, you got Carolina, New Jersey, that's this evening, and Ottawa, Toronto, that's this evening, both series 3-1. I think you and I would both be surprised. Give full credit to Ottawa, give full credit to Carolina, but to New Jersey, but I think you and I both would be surprised if Ottawa or New Jersey were able to come back and win those series. Those stranger things have happened, so we'll see. But the series, so you're covering a really good series. The series that Derek Van Deest, our writer in Edmonton, is covering is wild. Like, it's just crazy what's happening in these games. And last week, I said last week that I thought the Oilers blew an opportunity in game one, even though they were down in that game 4-0 and then 5-2. They came back and then they blew it again and they lose 6-5. I thought they blew an opportunity, the Oilers, because they didn't win that game, because I didn't think that would happen to the Kings again. It's happened every game, Sean. Like, it's weird. You know, even game two, they're up 3-0 in game two, and then it's 3-2 early in the third period. They come, they respond, they win that one 6-2. They're up 3-1. I'm sorry, they're up 3-2 and 4-3 in game three. They give up 4 goals in the third period and lose 7-4. They're up 3-1 in game four in the third period, and they lose in overtime. Like, I'm shocked that this has continued to happen with the Kings almost about every game in this series.
It's the numbers. Like, you just talked about what the scores are.
They're way too high for LA hockey.
Like, that's not who the Kings are. The Kings are one of the best defensive teams. They have two shutdown centers. They have elite defensemen, and they have a Vezina finalist goalie. Like, they should be playing 3-2 games, not 7-6 games.
Right.
It's not their comfort zone. And when they play loose like that, or when they sit back, I think the thing they're most guilty of is when they get a lead, they go into a prevent defense. The Edmonton Oilers, and I don't think I'm insulting anybody by saying this, are not a good defensive team.
Correct.
So the
don't disagree there.
The best way to keep them on their heels is to attack them. You're up 3-0, attack.
Mm-hmm.
Because you keep them in their own end, they can't generate. Look, Bouchard has been a hero in this series with the Bouch bomb. It covers a lot of sins, one of which is he's not very good in his own end. But once the Kings get a lead, they don't put any pressure on the Oilers, and they absorb all the pressure. And when you have two of the best players in the world coming at you, and then you have all kinds of playoff-tested guys coming at you like Corey Perry and others who just have this mental fortitude that's hard to explain, you're not going to survive. You have to make them work. You have to tire them out so they can't come into your zone and just dominate. And you know, I think that's a huge part of it. And I think the other part of it is they cracked a little in game four.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So they score that goal to tie the game, and it gets reviewed. It's a good goal. And then they challenge it for goalie interference. Call doesn't go their way. I don't think anybody thought it was going to go their way. They clearly saw something that nobody else saw. And Edmonton scores 10 seconds into the power play, just like I think everybody knew they would. You know, and it was funny because then the next night, Vegas played in the 4-3 overtime game, and there were two goals that could have been challenged. There was a Kaprizov goalie interference call, and there was a Foligno hand pass call. And as we were walking out of the press conference, I asked Bruce Cassidy if what happened in LA affected his decision not to call those, not to challenge those. And he kind of laughed, and he was like, well, I don't know. You know, everything's done in the moment. But it's got to be there for coaches now. He's like, I was watching it with the sound down. I was talking to my family. You know, I wasn't sure exactly what happened. And then he said to me, he goes, have you gotten an explanation? Have they explained why they did that? And I said, no, not that I know of. I shut the TV off and went to bed. But that could be the turning point of the series.
Yeah, absolutely. Listen, all you need to know about this series right now is that the Los Angeles Kings are outscoring the Edmonton Oilers 14-6 through the first 40 minutes. And then the Oilers are outscoring the Kings 12-5 from the third period on. That's all you need to know. So you can build your lead all you want. If you can't play in the third period and hold it, you cannot win in the playoffs. You cannot win playoff hockey by playing third periods the way the LA Kings are playing it. So we'll see how that changes. Our interview with Amelie is going to be coming up shortly, but Sean, I would be remiss if I didn't talk about the series that I've been on. Okay, it's 3-1 Washington. That's the series I'm covering. Washington, I've been covering. I did not do games 1 and 2. Tom Galitti was there. I went to Montreal for 3 and 4. I'm going to be in D.C. for game 5. We'll see if it goes to 6. I'll be there. Forget about the Capitals and the Canadians and 3-1 and all that. Let's put that aside for a second here. There is no better place to watch a playoff hockey game than the Bell Center. Blew me away. And I've been in the Bell Center for playoff games. I covered the Washington Montreal series in 2010. I covered the Rangers and the Canadiens in 2014 in the Eastern Conference Final when Chris Kreider ran Carey Price and everybody in Montreal was hunting Chris Kreider. I covered the 2017 series between the Rangers and the Montreal Canadiens, which was the last time they were able to fill the building there for the playoffs. You were there in 2021 when they couldn't fill the building in the Stanley Cup Final. Unbelievable atmosphere. And when you hear things like there's no crowd like it, it's so true. That crowd, the anthems and crazy, the noise, the dinner, that crowd, you could be looking down. That crowd will tell you that something's happening 10 seconds before it happens because they start to roar 10 seconds before the play. They just have a sense. It is unbelievable, Sean.
It's organic. It's very European soccer-ish. Yeah. You know, when you watch a European soccer game, you understand very early in a build-up that this is an important moment because the crowd organically, it's part of their DNA. They understand the game. You know, you're kind of sitting there and you're like, what's everybody getting excited about? And then there's this cross getting whipped in and it's almost a goal. And you're like, oh, how did they know that? And it's the same thing in Montreal with hockey. Like, you know, there's crowds that are as loud as the Bell Center, you know, Carolina,
Vegas.
There's places that get loud. Minnesota. There's places that are loud. There's places that are passionate, but there's no place. And all my Toronto friends are going to come and find me.
No way. No shot.
I understand, but there's no place where it's that natural. There's nothing forced. There's no clapping. There's no make some noise. There's nothing forced. There's nothing generated. It's all very organic. That's the only way for me to explain it is it's a part of the fabric of the game there. And it has been forever. And it really is an amazing thing to watch, especially while you're having a hot dog.
All right.
How many, Dan? You've been there for two games. How many?
Two for game three, none for game four. Didn't do them for game four. I tell you, I thought they were a little overrated in game three. Just me, you know. I think they were a little overrated, but I did not do them for game four, but two for game three. The hot dogs, by the way, in Montreal are a thing in the press box. They are the thing to do in, you know, during the intermissions there.
But it's not for the press box. It's for everybody. It's for the players. They get delivered to the dressing rooms after the game for the players to eat. Like, it is a thing. Like, it's a special thing. And it was even more so at the Forum. I was lucky enough to go to the Forum because I'm 9 trillion years old. But it's not just the grazing herd of media members. It goes well beyond that. They're legendary. There's been stories written about it. And you talk to any Quebec player, and he'll tell you all about the Chinchotes.
Well, there were about 9 or 10 players from the Laval Rocket in the press box for the games 3 and 4, and they were all online for hot dogs. Okay, and they're about to go play in the Calder Cup playoffs, and they were all online for hot dogs. By the way, that series too has had some crazy stuff. Like, do you ever see a skirmish, melee, whatever you want to call it, spill onto the bench, right? And that was between Tom Wilson and Josh Anderson. And it only happened because the door was open, right? You see those things all the time at the end of periods, especially in the playoffs, a little pushing, shoving. You know, the linesman comes in and he separates it, but the door was open. So it came through. And then I think the linesman, I think his name was Kyle Flemington, he had to go in there and he's like laying on everybody. But the best thing is, if you watch the video of that, Sean, the Washington Capitals equipment trainer grabbed a broken stick and just like defended himself with a broken stick. And then Carberry was like, where do I go? It's coaching staff. It was a thing. It was a sight to see. And then you have the goalie, you have the e-bug getting dressed, going onto the bench. Why is there an e-bug? Why don't they have a third goalie? Oh, they do. He's in Laval, Caden Primo, but he's not on the roster. He's in Laval. he makes it to the Bell Center in time for the third period too. Like, it's wild stuff was happening in Montreal.
Yeah, and I mean, that all started right at the warm-ups. It was like right out of Slapshot.
Yeah.
Patrolling the red line, the center ice line, and yapping, and all you needed was during those beautiful anthems was for somebody to say, "I'm trying to listen to the song." It's such a part of that series, because you think about it, right? Like, here's the Washington Capitals, and they've been there and they've done that. They've won the cup. They have some grizzled gray beards in Ovi and players like that. And then you have this really young Montreal team with very little experience, very little of any of that. And it's very clear to me that part of the game plan, and Montreal has showed well, better than I thought they would, even though they're down 3-1. Clearly part of the game plan is to intimidate them.
It's not working. They're not intimidated.
No, but
they're not intimidated. They're just not as good. They're just not as good. They're just not as deep. They're just not that to me, that's why this is a 3-1 series. Like, Washington's depth showed up in the third period of game four, and great hit by Tom Wilson. And it was a game changing hit because they scored 11 seconds after or 15 seconds after that hit. But to me, it's the depth. It's that's where it's at. But you watch the Canadiens though. This is going to be a really good team, and it's going to be a really good team for a long time. Look at their power play, right? So Patrick Laine had to come out of the lineup. He was not playing well, number one, and now he's out with an upper body injury. And I was told by a few people, like, he wasn't really shooting one-timers that well. Could be a wrist thing. We don't know. But he really didn't play well in games one and two of the series either. But they put Demidov, I think it's Ivan Demidov is how he likes to pronounce it, onto the power play. Suzuki, Demidov, Caulfield, Hudson, Slavkovsky, they're all 25 and younger. And wow. Like, that could be their next, that could be their top power play for the next 5-10 years. And it is lights out good. So you see it with the Canadians right now. They're way ahead of where anybody thought they would be at this point. And they're just, to me, just simply not as good or as deep as the Washington Capitals. But Marty St. Louis said it, and he's right. Our good is really good. They just have not been able to sustain that long enough to be even in this series.
And that's something you learn. And this is going to serve them so well going forward. All of these young players, this is their first taste, and they're going to want to get back there, and they're going to be more prepared when they do. And you're right. Their young players they just zip it around, man. It's beautiful to watch.
Remarkable. How about we learn a little bit about Florida Panthers and the Tampa Bay Lightning, and a little bit about what's going on with the Boston Bruins. What do you think? Should we get to Emily?
Before we get to Emily, we need to hear this word from Skip.
Brie Food, beauty. Skip 60 to scores here. Get even more wins during the Stanley Cup playoffs. How to play, you ask? Place a game day order to play. Pick your team and get your minute. If either team scores during that time, you score a $25 Skip voucher. Order and play 60 to score in the Skip app to take your shot. Now until May 19th, get her one. Emily, thanks so much for joining us. So what's it like down there in sunny South Florida? You're enjoying yourself in this series, 3-1, Florida?
It's a terrible burden. I'm here, I'm in Florida, I'm driving between the cities. It's warm, it's nice, there are beaches. Much like the series Tracy is covering in Winnipeg and St. Louis.
Yeah. I actually see Sean raging right now.
Raging, dude, I'm in Vegas. I was just going to say that I'm sorry that I helped to sign her that series.
It's a terrible burden.
The series, though, is quite interesting. It flipped big time last night in game four in 11 seconds. It flipped. What do you make of what's happening here to the Tampa, not so much what the Panthers are doing, but what's happening to the Tampa Bay Lightning here? Because they were the team everybody was looking at coming in. I was looking at them coming into the playoffs and saying, listen, I think they may be the best team in the East. I think they're the team to beat, right? All this stuff. And then they're stumbling.
Yeah, it just hasn't quite worked. I mean, the Panthers are a team that like to get up in your face, in your business. Like, they like to push, and they like to you know, they don't relent. They don't give in. And Tampa is a team that doesn't play quite as well when they have that much pressure in their faces. So this is turning out to be a really tough matchup for them. It's actually funny that game, you know, there were two sets of goals in 11 seconds yesterday. It flipped and then it flipped again. My kids went to bed between when it was 2-1. And when I talked to them this morning, I was telling them that the Panthers won. They scored twice in 11 seconds. And my older son corrected me. He said, no, that was the Lightning. And I was like, no, it was the Lightning. And it was the Panthers. So last night was kind of a wild game. But the Lightning are definitely underperforming, I think, where a lot of us thought they would be in this series.
Well, and I think most surprisingly, it starts with Andre Vasilevsky. I can't remember a time when I've seen him struggle so much.
Well, last season, he had a tough season. He bounces back this year, has a season where he's in the top three for the Vezina Trophy, as was just announced. And then he hasn't quite put it together. You know, this is a guy who, as you said, he has so many big game moments. He has proven it over and over again in the playoffs that he can do this, that he can be this goalie that they need, that he can stand on his head. And, you know, maybe they'll get that in game five. Maybe that will be his moment to sort of get that back. But he hasn't been that so far in the series.
It's interesting. Neither is Connor Hellebuyck in the Winnipeg series, right? And these were arguably the top two goalies in the league through the course of the season. It's just, you know, that's just an interesting part. But Sean, you bring up Vasilevsky, and as we continue to hammer the Lightning here a little bit, Kucherov had three assists in game three. He's got one assist in the other three games. Gensel had 3 points in game three. Not much doing in the other couple games. Points got a couple goals. What are the Panthers doing then to them, to the Lightning? That is it just that in-your-face play? Are they just all over them?
They are. I mean, it's been interesting. The first three games were really, I almost want to say, tentative between these two teams. It felt like neither wanted to make a mistake. And maybe I was talking to some people in the press box last night. Maybe that was because both of these teams felt like they could make it to the Stanley Cup final, felt like they could win the cup. So if you're on a team that feels like you can go that far against another team that feels like it can go that far, you don't want to be the team that makes that mistake, that makes that unforced error. And I think they sort of broke out of that last night in game four, and they were playing a little bit more up and down. They, you know, took a few more chances. And I think, you know, the Panthers just have such belief. Brad Marchand was talking about it last night. They just have so much belief in what they can do, no matter what the situation, what the game. They're calm, they're collected. They feel like they've earned this and they can do it again.
And Dan just talked about, you know, Tampa's big guns haven't come to the fore. Florida's really haven't either.
And then that's what it takes often. You guys know, as you watch these series, you need that third line to score a goal. You need those depth guys to provide some offense. The defensemen, like last night for the Panthers, you need those guys to come through, which is why it's so interesting that the Panthers, for example, have a guy like Brad Marchand playing with Lundell and Lusterainen as opposed to playing up in the lineup. That makes that third line a lot more dangerous. You see them score last night. You see sort of the wheels and how they're working for Paul Maurice. But to go back to that earlier point, you're not wrong. They need goals from Nikita Kucherov. I mean, he has not scored since game one in 2023. That is a long time ago for a guy who, you know, is one of their primary goal scorers.
Yeah, they need goals from him. They just need offense from their top guys. And when you're, like you said, I mean, like when you're struggling in a series, those are the guys you look at. When you're winning a series and your third line's helping, your top line guys are feeling less pressure. It's just simply, that's what it is. You've been around Brad Marchand for years. Now, I didn't know how this change would work for him, you know, and especially he's coming off of an injury. Yet he's playing with Lundell and Lusterainen, and you got Paul Maurice saying, like, he's making these two young guys better. Those two young guys are Stanley Cup champions last year, and they played a big role in that, right? So what is Marchand's role? What is Marchand doing to help these Panthers right now?
I mean, Maurice was talking about last night. He was up and down the bench. He was talking. He was telling them that they had this. He was making sure they were calm. He was checking in with guys. And that is the value of a guy who has won a cup. Not that most of these Panthers haven't won a cup, but you know, has the gravitas of having won a cup. He's been a captain in the National Hockey League. He's a longtime veteran. He's from the school of Zdeno Chara and Patrice Bergeron. So he just has, it's funny to say the word gravitas with Brad Marchand, because I don't think a lot of people would put those two together,
No.
but he has that sort of seriousness of purpose, with a lighter side that sort of keeps it both calm but also, focused on the task at hand. And I think he has fit really incredibly well in with this team. He loves the lifestyle. He's sort of wondering how he ever did it for so long in a northern city already, and he's been here like 2 months. So he really has been a huge piece for them, a huge addition.
So the question becomes, A, are you coming back when you're done, or are you going to pull a Marchand? And B, is he turning Finnish with those two guys? We always joke about Seth Jarvis being the honorary Finn in Carolina, but I don't think I've ever met a more Finnish North American than Brad Marchand. Like, that's who he is, right? Like, he's happy-go-lucky and snarly at the same time. He's all those things. Like, he may start to learn to speak Finnish soon, I think.
Maybe he probably is. He can get Tuukka Rask to tutor him for a little bit, or maybe he's already gotten some tutoring.
I bet you he knows all the swear words.
No question, absolutely no question. But it is interesting. You get these guys, and you don't know how they're going to fit in. But given the DNA of this Florida Panthers team, given who they have already, it seemed like he was going to slot right in, and it really has worked out very well for them.
You know what's I find interesting with this series too, Panthers Lightning, is sort the teams are in a way, maybe this is unfair, but the teams in a way are kind of going as the coaches are going. You know what I mean? Like you've got John Cooper taking the line from Paul Maurice, right? And then Maurice saying, yeah, I was laughing about it. He chirped me, like just like free and easy. And I love Cooper. His energy and his emotion on the bench last night. I totally understand where he's coming from and all that. And then after the game, it's frustrating, and he's kind of testing the media and saying, "Well, you're asking me about hits again. I'm going to ask you about it." Well, that's not the job. Like, the job is you are supposed to. Whereas Maurice is sort of just, being Paul Maurice, the way we've seen him in the playoffs the last couple of years, and the team has sort of taken the cues from that. Do you see that as well, being up close and personal to it?
Yeah, I think Cooper has gotten frustrated this series, and I think both coaches are sort of sick about talking about hits and about potential suspensions and about that sort of extracurricular stuff. They'd both rather be talking about hockey, and they'd both rather be talking about what their teams are doing well. And I think it has definitely taken a toll in this series that they are forced, not wrongly, they should be asked these questions, but that they are having to have these conversations. And I think it is certainly easier to handle that well when you are up 3-1 in the series than when you are down. But yeah, we definitely did see some frustration from Cooper last night, both on the bench and in the post-game press conference. We also saw some jubilant celebration from Cooper,
Yeah, we
but
did.
by the end of the game, that celebration part was pretty much over.
Dan, you have a little bit of a short-term memory.
I do.
Yeah.
Are you testing me? Are you questioning
No,
me?
but I don't recall Paul Maurice being a ray of sunshine during the final against Vegas.
No, probably not. The team was losing too.
Well, and that's what it reflects. Like, I just think, and look, I think it's hard because those two guys have such respect for each other. They built hockey in Florida together. Over the last couple of years, they play constantly. They're the elite in the East. I think they understand each other and respect what each has done. And much like teams knowing that they could go to the Stanley Cup, and if they don't, it's going to be a huge disappointment. I think both of these guys know each other and have some empathy for each other, and I think that makes it more difficult.
Yeah, Cooper said the other day, he said, we're friends. He said we're friends. So, the fact that they were earlier in the series chirping each other a little bit, but things have turned. Again, it's different when you're only down 2-1 than now that you're down 3-1. And I think the frustration and the wear and tear is showing a little bit.
All right, let's flip it to the Boston Bruins, the team you cover the most. Mike Sullivan is available. I think we could ask this question to anybody who's around the Rangers, the Flyers, any team that's got a coaching opening right now. But he's from Boston, the Boston area, right? He's a BU guy. I look at the Bruins job and I think that could be a pretty good job too. It's a great time for a guy like Mike Sullivan to become a coaching free agent when you look at the Bruins and the Rangers and the Blackhawks and the Flyers. I mean, these are solid, stable organizations, right? What do the Bruins need? What are the Bruins looking for in your mind right now? And I mean, obviously, with Mike Sullivan being available, it's probably a game changer for a lot of teams. I would imagine it is as well for the Boston Bruins.
Oh, yeah. I think they would hire him in a heartbeat. It didn't end well for him the first time he coached the Boston Bruins. That was obviously a long time ago at this point. The Bruins also have something that really no other team can offer. His daughter, his grandson are in Boston. He would have a chance to coach his son-in-law, which I guess could be good or bad for family dynamics, depending on the day. Mm-hmm. So there are some, I think, enticing things. I think Sullivan really liked coaching Charlie McAvoy at Four Nations. I think that was they both talked about how wonderful that was as a moment for their family. And they talked about how they had discussed, you know, maybe someday I could coach, you know, if Charlie went to Pittsburgh or if Mike, right. You know, so, and I don't think they really considered it as an actual possibility, but yeah, I think that Sullivan would provide a lot of the things that the Bruins are looking for. They're looking for someone who can be a little bit more creative offensively while still having that defensive backbone structure that this team has always been known for. I mean, this is a position that would come not without pressure, but Sullivan knows that. He is used to pressure. He has done this before. So it would be a good marriage. But as you said, there are going to be so many teams that are out there looking for him. You know, the Bruins have some other guys, I think, that they could consider in a Jay Leach. You know, I think he probably will be at the top of their list. He's an assistant right now. If they are okay with going with someone who was part of this season's sort of disaster, he is, I think, an up and coming name that maybe other teams might be looking at as well. But, you know, I am sure a lot of teams were calling Mike Sullivan yesterday in the wake of the news saying, we're here for you. We have a lot of money for you. Come join us. It'll be great. So I'm sure the Bruins were among them.
Would he make a difference for the Bruins where they are now?
I think a lot of that comes down to what do they do in free agency? You know, I think they have some needs. They have some dramatic needs. They are suddenly a much younger team than they were, given the changes they made at the trade deadline. But no, they don't have a lot in the system. So they need to go out and fix that. They need to find a way to maintain the level that they have become used to, which, you know, may have Don Sweeney's job riding on that next season. Cam Neely did not commit to re-signing him as GM, but for now it is in his hands. So yeah, it's a tough situation for the team. It's not like a Anaheim, for instance, where you see it's so enticing with the young talent and the structure they have put in place for what's coming there. It's not the same as that. But it's a team that has two excellent defensemen. In theory, one of the top goalies in the NHL, maybe. We'll see, you know, the jury's still out right now on Jeremy Swayman, but there are pieces. You have one of the best goal scorers in the NHL and David Pastrnak. There are pieces there, but it's not a slam dunk.
Did this season take them by surprise? Like, were they shocked at how this all went this season?
Yes. Yes. No question. I think they're still shocked. I think there's still a sense of like not understanding how this all went so wrong. And it went wrong from the absolute start. It went wrong right from training camp. You know, you start with the Jeremy Swayman, I don't even know what to call that. The contract dispute, the kerfuffle, the, you know, war of words, whatever it was with Jeremy Swayman, it really started from there and it went downhill immediately. You fire a guy who has proven that he is a very good coach in Jim Montgomery. You make a change, it doesn't work, and it just goes south from there. And you know, they will be rewarded with the best draft pick they've had in quite some time. But I think anyone you ask in that organization is still sort of stunned and shell-shocked from what this season turned out to be.
And all of Toronto is stunned and shocked that you're not there and you're in South Florida instead.
You know, I think maybe I might be there sooner than later.
Yeah, all these series 3-1 and The West is a little tighter than that. Emily, this was great. Thanks so much for hopping on with us. Now get in the car and drive.
I got a long drive ahead of me, so I got my coffee and I'm ready to go.
There you go. Thanks so much.
Thanks, guys.
Great stuff there from Emily covering the Panthers and Lightning, and we brought it up, Sean. Mike Sullivan. I mean, I was on a flight at the time that dropped yesterday morning. You hear him at their breakup day in Pittsburgh when they were, you know, their last day, and he's saying, "I want to be here. This is my job. I want to coach here. This is what." And I thought for sure that's where he would be, you know. But then you listen to Kyle Dubas, and certainly sounds like Kyle Dubas had other ideas, and time to move on, and, you know, mutual, however you want to call it. Was it mutual? Maybe it is. I mean, it's a good time for Mike Sullivan, like I said, to get into being a coaching free agent. At the same time, I think he wanted to see if he could do it there in Pittsburgh. I think it was a challenge for him in Pittsburgh. And I think part of it, too, was he knew that, you know, Crosby had bought in. So he wanted to buy in, too. And he's not going to get that chance. Maybe it is mutual. Maybe it's good for him. But I do think part of him being the competitor he is, he probably doesn't like how this has all.
No, I think he's part of the fabric of Pittsburgh, right? Like, it's going to be hard for me to see the Penguins play next year with another coach behind the bench. Like, and I think Mike is, and I've said this even while the Penguins have been struggling the last couple of years, I think he's one of the best coaches in the NHL, right? Results be damned. He's a really good coach. I think Kyle laid out what he's going to do, and I don't think it aligned, right? Like, I don't think they're going hard rebuild. I don't know that you can do that in Pittsburgh, not with Crosby and Malkin there. But they're going to have to reload in some way. They're going to have to start to introduce some young players into that fabric. And it's going to take some time, right? And I don't know if Sully wanted that. You know what I mean? Like, he wants to win with Crosby, right?
Yeah, I don't know that he wanted it. But I think there was a challenge for him there to say, I can do this. Like, I can get us. We can get us back into the playoffs. We can do this while Kyle does what he does. And the best always think they can win the challenge, right? I mean, that's why they're the best. That's why they are at such a high level, because they accept and they look at these challenges and they take them on. It's been 3 years out of the playoffs now for the Pittsburgh Penguins, and it got to eat at Mike Sullivan. But then, Sean, you can look at it from the other perspective, too. How many coaches survive 3 years of not making the playoffs? He's one we're talking about in this way because he's so revered and because he's been such a good coach, a decade there in Pittsburgh, two-time Stanley Cup winning coach there. Most coaches in the NHL don't survive 2 years without a playoffs, depending on where the team is. 3 years? Very, very rare that you're going to see a coach still coaching that same team if he doesn't make the playoffs in 3 years.
Most coaches in the NHL don't make it 3 years.
Anywhere.
Regardless of their results. What Mike did in Pittsburgh is unbelievable. You know, and I thought he got a really bad rap, right? Like, at times. Like, you know, Pittsburgh fans, they're passionate and they have a lot of opinions, and, you know, Mike doesn't work well with the young kids. He doesn't develop players. Mike Sullivan's developed players are scattered all across the league because they wanted to win and they traded. You know, what's happening to the Pittsburgh Penguins is what's going to happen to the Boston Bruins. Right. And so when you guys talked about that being a perfect fit for who Mike is, where he's from, all of those things, the one thing I'd be really hesitant about is the Boston Bruins are on the front end of what Pittsburgh's on the back end. Boston has surrendered every asset that they have for a decade to chase cups. There's nothing. And I understand the cap's going up and you're going to be able to bring in players, but that's not sustainable, right? No matter what the cap is, with a salary cap, you need good young players. Look at every team in the playoffs. They have good young players because that's what you need.
The difference with Boston is their top guys are all in the prime of their careers. Pasternak, McAvoy, Swayman. They're in the prime of their careers.
Three guys out of 23.
No. But that's the difference from Pittsburgh. Their top guys are not. They're on the back end. Crosby's still unbelievable, but and may never have a back end. Who knows, right? But Malkin's on the back end. Letang's on the back end. Crosby's on the back end age-wise, right? Different. That's the difference in Boston that could be enticing. What's interesting is the most enticing jobs might be Anaheim and Chicago, right? You know, because they're so young. You can take those teams and you can mold them into what you want them to be. Those are teams that will fill through free agency. Like the Blackhawks, I would expect to go out and work to sign a big free agent. Maybe it's Mitch Marner. Maybe it's, who knows, right? I don't know, right? The Ducks may be the same. I don't know. But their cores right now are so young that those jobs might be the most enticing, because you can build and you can, if you succeed, you become what John Cooper is in Tampa. You know what I mean? Like you do it for forever, for decade and decade plus, and you mix and match out of some players here and there, but your core pretty much, you know, remains intact, and you build through that, and it's come up with you. That to me is, honestly, that to me is more enticing than Boston or the New York Rangers right now.
Yeah, I don't find either of those jobs enticing. Look, there's only 32 jobs. They're all enticing. Like, you know,
well, yeah, beggars saying cannot that, be, that perspective.
Beggars, yes, cannot be choosers. You know, like I said, because sometimes you wonder when somebody takes a job, you're like, why would they take that job, right? And you take that job because there's only 32 of them and you want to be the boss.
Right. Yes.
So here's a wild card for you. Vancouver. Rutherford thinks Mike Sullivan walks on water.
Yeah, he does.
He has the utmost faith in Mike, and rightfully so. And Rick Tocchet still hasn't signed there. He's been offered the richest contract in the history of the organization, according to reports. It's dragged out. They did not pick up the option, so if he doesn't take this contract, he's a free agent. There's several teams that he's played for that are looking for coaches.
Yeah.
So that could be a fit. Right. And that's a team that's kind of in the middle. Right. It's not a bunch of young kids like in Anaheim or Chicago, but it's not Boston or Pittsburgh.
So, yeah, no, I listen.
And they were a playoff team last year.
Yeah, that team has a chance. They're not far off. We know that. Right. They're not far off. And it is an interesting one if there is an opening there. But, you know, if there's an opening there, the first person that Mike Sullivan is going to talk about that team with is Rick Tocchet. They coach together in Pittsburgh. And if Tocchet doesn't sign there, if he's been offered that contract and Tocchet doesn't sign there, to me, that's a red flag for Mike Sullivan. Is it not?
Perhaps. Or perhaps.
Perhaps.
Perhaps Rick wants to go somewhere else.
Well, yeah. But why? Why does he want to go somewhere else? That's the question.
Well, there could be a number.
We don't know the answer.
The grass is always greener on right. The other side of the fence, supposedly. And you never know until you find out, right? So I'm just spitballing here, right? This is my weekly spitball session. I don't think I got any facts wrong this time, so I think we're good on that part of it.
Well, what about, I mean, another one to consider too, right, is the Seattle Kraken. Botterill's the new GM. He was there when Pittsburgh brought in Mike Sullivan. There's a relationship there, right? So there's relationships all over. That's what it's a small world, the National Hockey League. I think it's going to be quite interesting. What Mike Sullivan's availability, we can both agree, has changed the landscape of the coaching market for many, many teams. And where he ends up, it's almost like if he is going to coach next season, I would imagine he will. Where that is will have a domino effect on where everybody goes, I think. Maybe somebody hires a coach before somebody hires Mike Sullivan, because of that, if they do, they were told that they have no chance at hiring Mike Sullivan. He is the guy. It's, you know, right now it's probably still David Carl too, if he's going to move out of the University of Denver, but that's on a different level, obviously. So that one is going to be real interesting to see where it goes. But Sean, before we get out of here, we got to talk about a little more playoffs, and we got to talk about Connor Hellebuck. You know, I brought it up in the interview with Amelie. You brought up the Vasilevsky struggling, you know, for Tampa Bay, but Connor Hellebuck has been pulled out of the last two games for the Winnipeg Jets, both losses. Not good. Just not good. His numbers in this series, not good. He says he can fix it. He says he studied goaltending more than anybody else in the world, by the way. Connor Hellebuck studied more goaltending than anybody else in the world, according to Connor Hellebuck, and he can fix it. Well, he better, because the same narrative is following him around right now. And what happened in the Four Nations, that's long gone. Now we're back to playoff Connor Hellebuck. And maybe it's unfair to him. I don't know. There's some goals that are going off guys that in front of the net, off his own players, this, that, and the other. But great regular season. Probably going to win the Vezina. 2-2 in a series, and he's been pulled out of the last two games.
Other guys are making those saves. They're bouncing off of people. Like, at some point, you make your own luck, right? And I think it's confidence, and I think it's all of those things. The one thing I don't think gets enough credit or is understood enough is, look, you go to play Connor Hellebuck in the middle of December. Your video coach comes to you in the room, and he says, A, B, and C. Shoot low. Try to get him to move to his left. Whatever it is.
Let's try to get a win and move on.
It's simple. Now, you draw a series, right? And St. Louis knew for the last week of the season that they were going to play the Winnipeg Jets or the Vegas Golden Knights. And they had their goalie coach and their video guys locked up in rooms watching Connor Hellebuck and pre-scouting him. And this happens every year in every playoffs, especially in the first round. The presentation that was given to the St. Louis Blues was not 1 minute and go get them, boys. It was, if we do this, we do this, and we do this, we're going to break them. And they've done A, B, and C, and they've broken them. Like, I think, especially, again, in the first round of the playoffs, I the amount of preparation that goes into it, especially into the goaltending and breaking it down, is ridiculous. There are other people that are studying goaltending, and they're studying Connor Hellebuck, and they're figuring out how to break him down.
Well, yeah, but he studied more. So, you know, let's just be clear.
He should study shooters more, maybe. And I'm not being facetious. I'm not. Connor Hellebuck is a very dedicated man. He is a very serious man. He is an elite goaltender. But your reputation is made in the playoffs, right? You think about all the great goalies. There's a reason Patrick Waugh is considered by many to be the best goalie ever. He doesn't have the most wins. He doesn't have the most shutouts. He doesn't have the most anything. He was really hard to beat in the playoffs. Same thing with Ken Dryden, right? There's guys that just raise their game when it comes to the playoffs. Connor's never done that. And until he does, this will dog him. And it will be a storyline. And it doesn't just affect Connor Hellebuck, but it affects the whole team.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, here's his chance. Here it is. Tonight, Canada Life Center, Wednesday night, Blues, Jets, Game 5, 2-2 series. This is your shot, right? Go out and prove it. Can't go out and prove it? That narrative is going to follow you, and it's going to continue to follow you. So he's got an opportunity here to forget about what happened in Games 3 and 4, but the Blues don't forget. The Blues are rolling, and they're dangerous. We knew they were dangerous. And it's not just Sean. It's not even just Hellebuck. It's the Jets. The Jets have a narrative that followed them too, that they have to break. And here's an opportunity for them to do it. So we'll see if they do it. The series is 2-2. It's 3-2 now in Dallas, Colorado. By the way, Colorado and Tampa Bay were my Stanley Cup final picks. That's the matchup. Not going away from it. I can't. Those teams are still alive. By the time we talk next week, maybe I'll have a new prediction.
Mine's not much better, by the way. It's Vegas and Tampa Bay. So,
yeah, you got a shot.
Yeah.
You got a better shot than I do.
Yeah. Although, look, I'm not writing Colorado out of that series, right?
Absolutely not. No.
It's 3-2. Every game's been close. I still think Colorado has more weapons. I was shocked at the way the game turned out last night.
Yeah.
I watched it with our good buddy Brian Slagle here at the MGM, and we were talking about it. And, you know, I just, they're so hurt, right? Like, Brian's such a big Dallas fan. And He's like, without Heiskanen, I don't see a way out for them. But they're finding a way out, right? And I don't think until last night, Ottinger was elite. And they're still finding a way out. I mean, they won their first two games without ever leading.
Yeah.
They
They're
led
finding
to a
ways.
minute and 4 seconds.
Finding ways. Well coached. Goaltending is showing up. The guys are showing up. Guys are stepping up. They're finding ways. That's what you got to do in the Stanley Cup playoffs. The Florida Panthers are doing it. They've been doing it for several years. Look, there's a lot that's going on.
We didn't
We're
even
gonna
talk
have.
about the best thing in that series. And we have to really quick before we go. Landeskog. What an unbelievable story. However it turns out, for him to come back, there was I don't know who did it, so I can't give them credit. There was a mic'd up segment for his first game.
Yeah, that was great.
And everybody was coming up to him. The referees, the other
Jamie
team,
Benn.
yeah, and then call him an old man,
Yeah.
like, but the amount of respect in those comments, in the heat of the moment, it tells you all you need to know, because those guys understand it's hard to come back from a 3 month injury, or a season ending injury, a 3 year injury. Like, those guys understand how lonely it is, how much doubt there is, how miserable it is to be alone and to have to work and work and not know if there's an end and not know if you're ever going to play again. I don't know that there'll be a better story in these
Yeah,
playoffs.
that might be the best story in the playoffs. It's certainly one of the right now. It's probably and it's a shame that we waited this long to talk about it, actually. It's probably the best individual story going on right now in the playoffs. We'll see how long it goes for, but the fact that he did it, and you're right, I saw that video too, and the level of respect that this guy has is remarkable and well earned,
And
really. I mean, just well earned.
he was so comfortable in it. Like,
Yeah.
you could tell, like, and everybody's like, why do they do it, right? Why do guys do it? Why did they come back? Why they've made all the money in the world? That's why. So Jamie Benn can tell him he's an old man. That, like, it's really that simple. Like, that camaraderie, that competition. It's an elite fraternity. You don't ever want to leave an elite fraternity until you have to. Like, there's nothing that can replace that. And it's such a simple thing, but it's all they know. And it's addicting, right? Like, to play in games like that, what a privilege. And to play against men like that, like, you're playing against the best at your profession. Night after night. Like, what a privilege that is. And for him to work that hard to get back and to be able to do it, it's mind-boggling.
This is an elite fraternity, this podcast. This is a privilege every week, Sean. Unfortunately, we do have to end it.
It is an elite
love
fraternity
doing it.
because it's just two people.
Two of us. And we think we're both elite, so we're going to go with it. All right? We have to end it now, but we'll be back next week because we continue to keep coming back, just like Gabriel Landeskog, and we'll see if the Avalanche can do it themselves as well. Listen to the podcast brought to you by Skip. Skip to the good part. Get groceries, meals, and essentials delivered right to your door on Skip. Enjoy the playoffs.